nothing like starting the day with a nice hot cup of tea. Unless you think about the labor that went into making that cup of tea possible.
I'm Genevieve LeBaron. I'm a professor at the University of Sheffield. I have been studying forced labor, and especially the business of forced labor in different types of supply chains, both in the U.S. and abroad.
So we're sitting here having a morning cup of tea together. As someone who cares about fair labor practices, what should I be worried about related to the green tea I'm drinking here?
There's a lot to be worried about, is the bad news. Workers in tea supply chains often pick about 80 kilograms of tea a day, which is enough for about 25,000 tea bags, and would typically make between a pound and a pound 50 an hour.
You're talking about a British pound?
A British pound, that's right.
Which would be about $1.50 at the moment?
Yeah. It's backbreaking work. And I think the very worrying thing is that I've just done a large study of tea supply chains where we found that the worst forms of labor abuse, including physical coercion, gender-based violence, sexual violence, are quite common at the base of the tea supply chain among tea pickers and tea workers.
And that's just a small part of a universe these days of underpaid labor, forced labor, even modern-day slave labor that can end up in your grocery cart and on your table.
The official estimate is that about 25 million workers annually are victims of forced labor. So that's the worst forms of abuse. Work has to be involuntary, and it has to be accompanied by some form of coercion. That's the sort of tip of the iceberg, though, of labor abuse in general. And what we find is that they reinforce each other.
You'll find the fruits of that labor when shopping at your local grocery store. Want some tea? Chocolate? Maybe artisanal, locally produced cheese? Surely that's okay. Not necessarily. Modern-day slavery has become a business model in sometimes unexpected sectors. So, what can you do as you load up your grocery cart to make sure you're not unintentionally supporting an unfair system that sounds like it's from another century? It's complicated, but keep listening and it'll become clearer. This is Whose Century Is It?, a podcast about ideas, trends, and twists shaping the 21st century. I'm Mary Kay Magstad, a former international correspondent for a couple of decades in Asia. And this podcast started as a way to think about claims that the century, quote-unquote, belonged to one nation state or another. It quickly morphed into thinking about power and potential and risks and how they affect different groups of people around the world in this century. And that's why the focus this time is on modern slavery and its close cousin, grossly underpaid labor. Both make it close to impossible for workers to build toward a better life. Take the example of tea, as my guest in this episode, Genevieve LeBaron, did in her study.
We found that having very low wages, workers are paid around 25% of minimum wage is what we found they're actually taking home at the end of the day. Those types of conditions of just generally very low wages, very hard work, no ability to accumulate savings is what gives rise to the more extreme forms because workers will end up having no safety net. So if a child gets sick, if there's an urgent need that they don't have any ability to meet except by borrowing money, often from their employer, then they end up in situations where they're charged, say, 100% interest rate, they're in debt bondage, and that can lead to a whole bunch of other things. You know, we don't have great data at a kind of macro level of how widespread labor exploitation is, but certainly in the industries I've looked at, you find that these patterns of abuse are very widespread. They're endemic. So, you know, we have had in our study, 60% of workers had no savings, no money in the bank. Many of them were in debt. And again, these are more minor forms of abuse. They're not forced labor. But if you look at what are the root causes of forced labor in the supply chain, being poor, not having an ability to accumulate money, not having any savings, being very vulnerable in general terms, as most people in the supply chain are in tea, that gives rise to the more extreme forms of abuse.
So that's the root causes on the supply side, you know, the workers who are showing up and saying, I can't find a better deal than this. But on the demand side, the people who are employing them or who are forcing them to work. What are the root causes? Why are they turning to this kind of labor?
That's a great question. I think there's been a long time in the field and in media, there's been this idea that these are just kind of bad apple employers, that, you know, this is a hidden crime that has to do with corrupt, bad individuals exploiting helpless people. And I think that the research now shows very much that that's not true. What you have is a systemic demand for forced labor in many industries. And it relates to the fact that, for instance, in this case, tea plantation owners and managers, you know, they're not actually making enough money to pay minimum wage due to the rising costs of inputs, due to climate change. When I interviewed, you know, many plantation owners and managers, they said, look, we think this is terrible, but the fact is, if we paid minimum wage, we'd go out of business. In a situation where there's been such a concentration of the profit and the value that's produced in many goods at the top of the supply chain, that the business actors towards the bottom of the chain are really, really getting squeezed. So you have a situation where there's a need to kind of balance the books through different forms of labor exploitation, be it underpayment, be it usurious interest rates through debt, be it delayed payment of wages, all sorts of things.
So in some ways, it kind of goes back to one of the original sins in this country, slavery, and how that drove economic growth and made the South relatively prosperous for a long time, and the North for a while as well. I mean, to me, it's always seemed like there's this interesting disconnect where people are arguing, well, you know, we need this for our economic growth. We need this to have a viable business model. And it leaves aside, you're doing this to other human beings. I mean, have you talked to people who are employers about how they feel about what they're doing?
Yeah, I have. It's quite troubling, actually, and it's quite interesting to see through their eyes how they see these things. We did a lot of the interviews with workers first, so I knew what was happening at the base of the supply chain. In the tea and cocoa study, we included around 1,400 workers in our study. So we had very in-depth knowledge of the patterns that were occurring. And only after that did I interview the plantation owners and managers and those sorts of people. And when you talk to them, there's all these kinds of similar narratives about people being inferior on the basis of their ethnicity, people not being capable of having a better life, all these different ways that they rationalize. And it reminded me very much of what you'd read in history class about, you know, the 1860s in America, people trying to keep this justification for slavery in the face of a lot of public pressure that this wasn't right. You know, in some of these supply chains, you're at a similar tipping point where there's global scrutiny, global pressure, and actually the business owners are often in a very difficult spot because if you look at how their families have made a livelihood for a long time, this is the business model. And because of the profits being concentrated so high up in the chain, there isn't really opportunity for them to change it and stay in business. So again, I think it's really important to recognize it's not just about moral shortcomings, though it's obviously illegal and a crime and heinous for all sorts of other reasons. But, you know, it is genuinely the way that they're balancing their books.
We were just talking about history, U.S. history, and we have this tendency, I think, to think, well, yes, but we've evolved past that. But if I were to push my grocery cart through an upscale grocery store right now and see, oh, you can get $12 a pound cheese made locally or other high-end products, quite often there's this kind of labor behind that too.
Yeah, that's right. Forced labor is not something that just happens overseas. In the U.S., we have a long history of slavery, and it's something that's never really gone away. And one of the most long-standing forms of slavery or unfree labor in the U.S. is prison labor. And prison labor today is a massive business, not just for small businesses and large businesses who sometimes set up shop in prisons and benefit from tax reductions and low labor costs and other things, but also for state and the federal government who have their own prison industries and are using prison labor as a way to pay for the cost of incarceration. So you've had a trend in the past 5 years or so where a lot of those state prison industries, so for instance, Colorado or California, they'll set up shop where they create their own industry programs for prisoners. And those have grown. They're growing at a very high rate across the U.S. And they make all kinds of goods. goods ranging from high-end motorcycles that sell for $30,000 to t-shirts. And food is really one of the big things that prisoners are making now, from almond groves to orchards to dairies. They're producing these products inside of prisons, sometimes also off-site, and those products are ending up in our grocery stores. And it's not, you know, we often think of goods that are made with forced labor or prison labor as things that would be cheap and undifferentiated. But in the U.S., there's a lot of evidence that actually businesses were using prison labor and continue to use prison labor as a strategy to compete when they're smaller, more local businesses. So if you're a cheese farmer in California competing against all this cheese that's being made cheaply by big agricultural companies, one way you can do that is by setting up in prison and having low-cost prison labor. And then you can put the buy local, you can put the, you know, made in X state. And so there's been a lot of information about how those have been sold in very high-end places, places like Whole Foods, who've recently banned now, I think, the sale of prison goods after they got a lot of heat for it a couple of years ago. But it's a growing trend across the U.S. is prison labor.
Do prisoners have a choice about whether to participate in these sorts of things? I mean, do they have to be helping to make the cheese that goes on the plates of well-to-do individuals in the Bay Area?
It varies very much by the type of prison labor and by state. So a lot of prison industries and a lot of regulation about what prisoners can be made to do while they're in prison. It happens at the state level. So California would have different rules than Washington, would have different rules than Vermont. In many states, prisoners can be required to work up to 40 hours a week. And what you see is that if you look at the different types of prison labor, which is, again, everything from kind of doing the laundry of other prisoners to working to run the prison in various ways through cleaning and construction to very high-skilled jobs. You know, in California, they train prisoners as underwater welders, all sorts of different jobs. What you see is that because prisoners are required to do some work and because the types of work that's available to them vary a lot by how much they're able to make in the different jobs as well as their conditions, then there's a preference for certain types of work over others. So most prisoners would rather not do the facility maintenance work for the state. Often those are the lowest paid jobs. They can just be paid $0 an hour in some states. Whereas if they're working for private companies, in most cases, they need to be paid minimum wage. The trick, though, is that, say, you have a prison allowing a company to use its prison labor force, the government would be able to appropriate a large amount of that wage that's supposed to be paid to prisoners. They could appropriate up to 80% in some states, so that actually, even though you say, oh, a prisoner should be making minimum wage, you know, 80% of that goes to the government towards room and board at the prison. So what you find is, even in that situation, maybe they would make $1 or $2 an hour for the work that they're doing. You know, from their point of view, that's looking pretty good because the alternative is doing more boring work and making no money. But then when you compare, okay, they're firefighting in California for $1 or $2 an hour.
Wait, let's pause here a moment. They're firefighting?
Yes. Yeah. Prisoners are firefighting. That's been one of the expansion areas of prison industries. California is, I think, the most famous case of that. They've got fire crews every summer now made up of prison workers, often female inmates, fighting fires alongside unionized firefighters who make $35 an hour or $40 an hour. And it's become a really interesting way that states are trying to basically save money in the face of having public deficits and budget crises.
And this is happening in California, which prides itself on being a progressive state.
Yes. And people have even tried to make the argument that this is somehow progressive because it's giving prisoners who often come from lower class backgrounds an opportunity for quote unquote skills training or job training. But there's been very little evidence to suggest that those prisoners actually benefit from that in the real world, you know, after they leave prison. There's not a lot of evidence that suggests they're getting hired as firefighters.
And when we're talking about these inmates, do you know the racial breakdown roughly?
That's a great question. I would love it if somebody did a study of prison workforces in terms of race. I mean, what we know about the prison population in general in the United States is that it's overwhelmingly men of color. So it's largely Black and Hispanic men in the 2 million or so prisoners in the U.S. I haven't seen data on how that breaks down in terms of who's getting the quote-unquote good jobs and who's getting the facilities maintenance jobs. I think it'd be really interesting to look at racial composition of the labor force in that way within prisons. But I think it'd be very hard to study because, you know, that's not the sort of information that governments are willing to make available.
And now there are private prisons as well. What has your experience been in dealing with people who are running those?
They're even more shrouded in secrecy. So I did my PhD dissertation. I wrote it on prison labor. And initially, I set out to do a big study and a typology of the different types of prison labor in the U.S., which range from prisoners working for the government to prisoners working in prisons that are owned and managed by private corporations, doing work that would benefit the private sector. And what I found was that it's very, very difficult to get information about any prison industry. But at least the public ones often publish annual reports where they talk about the profitability of the industry is, what prisoners make, how much they're paid. They do have some duty to disclose about their industries, whereas the private prisons, they don't publish anything. We don't actually really know what's going on in terms of inmate labor within those prisons.
What did they say when you contacted them?
Sometimes you just get no reply. Sometimes you get, we don't really have the capacity or the bandwidth to deal with requests of this nature. Just basically nice ways of saying, please go away.
So no overt hostility, just kind of nothing to see here, move along.
Yeah, that's the general response. A lot of prisons have now kind of museums and little shops where they sell prison-made goods. So there is a sort of public-facing element to operations within some states. And so you often get referred to that, like, please come visit our museum. Angola, which is a very famous prison labor farm in Angola, Louisiana, you know, the land was a plantation under slavery. And so there are very gripping photos that have been done by journalists of largely Black prisoners in the cotton fields, you know, in 2018, supervised by white guards riding on horseback with big guns and the whole thing. And there's comparative photos where that same land in the 1860s, and it's so startling how similar the pictures are, how little it feels like things have changed. And they have a famous museum, an Angola prison museum, where they talk about the history of prison labor in the state.
With pride.
Yeah, that's one of the strange things about prison labor. There are a lot of people who think that this is a very good thing, that you're taking people who haven't had enough discipline and they haven't worked hard, and that's somehow how they've ended up in prison, and you're teaching them hard work and you're basically teaching them the rigors of being a member of the wage labor market. You know, there's been a lot of correctional industry push to use prison labor as a tool to make people productive. Of course, it's been a long-standing argument throughout the history of capitalism that poor people are somehow unproductive or lazy or not working hard enough, because if they were, they wouldn't be poor. You know, there's just been so many economic works and other works that have debunked that and shown that for a lot of people, there's really no mobility. They can still be working hard. You know, the tea workers I mentioned, they're working 7 days a week, 10 hours a day, and they're still incredibly poor, right? At the levels of potentially facing credible fears of starvation poor. And so there's this kind of myth that's been so longstanding in the history of capitalism that, you know, if you just work hard, you'll be able to lift yourself up by your bootstraps. And that fairy tale is now being spoken of in relation to prisoners.
It's also kind of a disingenuous trope, because it's like, if you work hard, you can pull yourself up by your bootstraps, but also we think you're lesser, and that's why you weren't working hard in the first place and why you're here. And so the fact that I'm exploiting you and maybe not paying you or hardly paying you is okay, because you're not worth that much anyway.
Yeah, I think that's very apt. That's very apt. That's spot on.
What drew you to this research?
That's a great question. I never set out to study slavery. I started out studying big brands. So I studied companies. But I was doing my undergraduate degree in Washington State at the Evergreen State College. And around that time, there was a lot of concern among activists about prison labor, that Washington State-based companies were closing down production facilities and moving those facilities into state prison industry. And so I guess that was something that always stuck out to me. I was curious about it. I was curious why companies would do that. You know, prison labor in the 13th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution is the exception to slavery. It's legally categorized as a form of involuntary labor or slavery. And I guess I wondered, you know, how could they be getting away with this? There was a lot of concern at that time about their practices overseas, like the anti-globalization movement and wanting to hold these companies accountable. But there didn't really seem to be much attention towards their practices at home. And this was one area where I just thought, gosh, this is really troubling. And so that stuck with me. And then when I went to do my PhD, I became really interested in why is unfree labor and forms of slavery so resilient in capitalism? We have all the myths about capitalism, right, that it relies on free labor and it's, you know, compared to other systems of the economy.
Free meaning voluntary.
Yeah. Voluntary labor, labor where you have the ability, if you're somebody in a society like the United States, you have the ability to decide who you want to work for and to quit anytime you're not happy. And that just isn't the case. And there, I guess I just became so curious about why is it that for some people that is the case, but then in every country I can think of, there are different groups of people for whom that's not the case. Often in developed countries, it's temporary foreign migrant workers who are very vulnerable to forms of forced labor, prisoners across different sectors, domestic work, you have high vulnerability. And then in the global south, there can be whole sectors, often the ones that are very important for GDP, like for instance tea and the countries that I've studied it in, where you just have endemic issues. Why is it that we have so much wealth, unprecedented wealth and profit and money, but distributionally, there's still some people who capitalism hasn't come with freedom for them. They're not able to choose their working conditions. They're not able to quit jobs that they don't want, all of those things for different reasons.
So are you approaching your work as, let's just see what's going on here, or do you hope to see change, and do you think that that's possible or likely, or where on the spectrum are we in terms of moving in one direction or another?
I think where we're at politically is a moment where there have been all these exposés by excellent journalists and by workers themselves who have reported on their conditions about forced labor in different types of products. So a few years ago, it was shrimp. And I think we're at the point now where governments are being pressured to act and they won't act. And they keep saying it's up to consumers whether or not they want to buy goods made with forced labor. But if you look at your grocery cart, even consumers who are willing to pay for ethically certified products or local products or high-end cheese or high-end this or that because they think that they are helping contribute to better conditions for workers and supply chains, that's not necessarily true anymore. And so I do think we're at a moment where governments need to step in and there need to be choices for consumers where genuinely you can buy things in your grocery cart that you know that workers were treated well and that they had rights and that they were paid a living wage in supply chains. And I think there are a lot of promising avenues for that. We certainly have the money, right? If you look at some of these supply chains, tea or chocolate, such a tiny, tiny fraction of the value that's being produced goes to workers. Most of it's sitting in profits that, frankly, those companies, they don't even know what to do with them anymore because they have so much profit. And what they could do with that money is pay their suppliers more, which would then in turn pay workers more, and essentially be more just and equitable about how the profits of the goods that they're selling are distributed. Workers are mobilizing a lot of solutions. Worker-driven social responsibility is one solution that I think is really promising in the U.S. and elsewhere. The Coalition of Immokalee Workers kicked it off in the U.S. They're tomato pickers, and they said we need to be paid more and we want an agreement directly with the brands who sell tomatoes, so not kind of the farm owners, but they went up to the consumer-facing brands and they've created the Fair Food Program, which includes basically a preventative model where workers have better wages. They also have their own hotline where workers can report exploitation. And essentially, they've built a monitoring system around wages and working conditions that puts workers at the center. So this isn't some kind of top-down PR thing led by a company. It's workers shaping their own conditions in a meaningful way. And we're seeing that model. It's now gone from tomatoes to dairy to other sectors. And I think that that is something really promising, as well as states needing to play a role in making sure that consumers are able to determine what has and hasn't been made with forced labor.
So should there like literally be a label that says forced labor free?
It wouldn't be a bad idea. The problem is that a lot of the labels that we have that we think and are right to think mean something along those lines haven't worked out. So you have the ethical certification schemes that say, if you look at their standards, they prohibit child labor, they prohibit forced labor, and they market themselves as opportunities for consumers to contribute to a just and fair and sustainable world. But then there have been all these different studies, including my own work, that show actually the labor conditions aren't good. You know, they're not meeting those standards. And so I think, sure, if there were a way to do a slavery-free label that was credible, that would be great. But it would take a lot of work, I think, to get that right and to learn from the lessons of the certification programs that really haven't worked in the past.
Yeah, and on that, like, so there's certified organic and there are various other things. A lot of these labels are available in upscale grocery stores. For the people who have a brother or a father or an uncle in prison who's doing the forced labor there, or out in the fields in other countries who are being grossly underpaid for the work they're doing, they often can't afford the types of foods that have the labeling on them. You know, they have to go for the cheapest available choice.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. When goods cost less, you know, you do the math and you figure out, well, if workers were paid minimum wage, you know, there's no way that this could cost this much. We also know that prices are not necessarily correlated with better working and living conditions. So I've been quite upset by my own research on tea and certified tea supply chains to find out that I've been paying twice as much for tea that was made with basically the same labor conditions as the cheapest tea on the shelf. So it's not necessarily the case that those of us who can spend more on our groceries are doing more to help workers in the global economy. There's too much research now that's shown that high-end goods, the extra money you're paying, it's not necessarily going to the workforce. So I don't think anyone needs to feel particularly guilty if they can't afford ethically certified products. I think buying less stuff in general is a good way to go.
But we all need to eat.
Yeah, food is, don't buy less food.
So next time I have my grocery cart out, you know, what can I do to at least be a little bit more ethical, a little more consciously ethical as I go through the different aisles and think about what I'm buying and what labor went into it?
That's a really tough question. I'm honestly torn. As somebody who's studied forced labor and food for so many years now, it's not a good news story. I think retailers have a role. You can look at modern slavery statements that grocery stores produce under US law or UK law, and you can read about their commitments to their sourcing practices and, you know, what considerations they have in terms of what they sell in their store. I know not everybody has time to read through modern slavery statements online, but for those of us who want accurate information and who really care about those things, I think that's a better place to start usually than the kind of PR and branding side of things.
So who's doing this well? Is there a country or are there countries that have recognized the problem and have regulations in place to make sure the products that come into their country actually meet higher standards in terms of labor practices?
Yes. It's important to say we're just at this huge moment of change in this whole landscape. In the past couple of years, a number of countries have passed different types of laws about this. Some of them are what are called home state regulations. So those are laws that, say, in the US or France or the UK, that require companies based in those countries to report on their supply chain. And in the food industry, that can often include grocery stores and it can include others. So it's not only about the kind of global supply chain, but also the domestic supply chain. And in some of those cases, these laws are very stringent. The French one is very interesting. It actually carries a penalty for companies who don't comply with a quite rigorous set of requirements about needing to report on human rights due diligence and different considerations. A lot of the legislation is quite shallow. You know, it doesn't mandate that companies report on the effectiveness of the initiatives that they're taking to address modern slavery. It just requires them to report on what they are doing, which may be things that we know are not effective, and there's nobody checking whether they're effective or not. So I'm not saying it's a kind of fix-all, but I do think it's important. I think another country to look at is Brazil, a very early player in fighting modern slavery. They have a super robust system where they blacklist businesses that are found to be using modern slavery. A lot of it has been in food. It's been in relation to beef and other food commodities. And so if you're found to be using modern slavery in Brazil, you can end up on a blacklist for 2 years, not being able to do business in Brazil. You have financial penalties. So there are countries that are doing this well. The U.S., interestingly, is ramping up its efforts to block the import of goods that are made with forced labor. Again, in relation to some commodities, I think you're going to have an issue where endemically those goods are made with forced labor. So what are we going to do, not have tea? I mean, there are some challenges with that sort of approach, I think, given how supply chains are set up now. But it's certainly on everyone's agenda. And I think we are seeing some interesting and meaningful pushes in the right direction.
And when you say, what are we going to do, not have tea? I mean, I remember back when I was a kid, there was the iceberg lettuce boycott. And like you could have said, what are we going to do, not have salad? But a lot of people didn't. And it actually had an impact.
Yeah. I mean, if you look back to boycotts and the role that they've played in history, you know, they've been hugely important, actually, in both drawing attention to slavery and to stopping it and to really hitting companies where it hurts, which is on, can you have access to the U.S. market to sell your products, right? What's complicated now in terms of monopolies is that we don't necessarily have the choice that we used to have where you could say, well, this tea is probably fine, but this tea is less fine, and try to use boycotts as a lever to get brands to change things. Because even though they have different brands, they're often owned by these very, 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 very big companies at the top. But when you look at it at a government level, federal government level, of just saying, we're going to block all the tea made in X country that we think is made with forced labor, then you're talking about, I think, a very serious, very important kind of holistic strategy.
But it's not just about keeping certain products from coming in. We have some cleaning up to do inside our borders as well.
Absolutely. And I think it's a perfect moment to remind everyone of that. I think the U.S. government, U.K. government, many governments are making public commitments to fighting modern slavery in the global economy, you know, really seeing themselves as champions of the cause. And I think the easiest and most realistic thing that they could do in the short term is to address all of these problems at home. And that's been, I think, a bit of a blind spot so far in the anti-slavery efforts. I haven't heard many people talking about prison labor, for instance, or temporary foreign migrant work programs. And these are very easy, I think, to reform. And I would hope that governments would put more time and effort into cleaning up their own backyards, as well as worrying about these problems in the global economy.
So we're talking about this on a podcast called Whose Century Is It? And my thought in focusing on this subject is it sure ain't the century of people who are being forced to work without being compensated for it. Do you feel like things are at least moving in the right direction, or that it's still a real possibility that at the end of the century, we'll look around and say, we've had these impulses as human beings in a capitalist society for a long time, going right back to slavery. And it appears that it's going to take a lot longer to be able to move past them.
It's a great question. You know, I feel both hopeful and really not hopeful, because I think that people are getting a grip on the fact that this is unsustainable. So you have now such a huge power imbalance between workers and the people who own and operate large companies. You have corporations having grown massively to the point that there's a lot of monopolies, there's a lot of kind of oligopolies. And so I think people are starting to talk about the right stuff. They're putting this problem of modern slavery very much in the context of how corporations now operate and are owned and are financed and run. And that's a big shift away from seeing this as a kind of peripheral human rights issue to being at the core of how capitalism operates and how corporations operate. So I think that we could be heading towards a moment where there's just a huge shift in how workers are treated and essentially the deal that they're getting as a whole within the global economy, which right now, admittedly, is a very bad deal, I think, across the board. But yeah, I'm always still an optimist.
Genevieve LeBaron, thanks for joining me on Whose Century Is It?
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure.
That's it for this time. Thanks to Genevieve LeBaron, professor of politics at the University of Sheffield in England, for her insights and her work on this subject. And thanks to the Global Reporting Center in Vancouver for bringing us together. Genevieve and I are both affiliated with it. If you like this episode, you can hear more of the 60-plus episodes of Whose Century Is It? Wherever you get your podcasts. While you're there, subscribe. And if you've got comments, questions, suggestions for future episodes, send me a note at whosecentury@gmail.com or message me on Twitter. I'm at Mary Kay Magstad, that's MaryKayMagistad, all one word. Or visit the Whose Century Is It Facebook page and leave a message there. Next time on Whose Century Is It? A look at the modern history of Chinese intelligence, as in spookery, and what that past might tell us about present and future Chinese efforts in that realm. Thanks as ever for listening. Back soon with another episode.